Good afternoon. I'm looking forward to your argument in Fuller v. State. Are you ready to proceed? Good afternoon, Mr. O'Donnell.
Good afternoon, Justice Holland, and may it please the Court. My name is Bernard O'Donnell, and I am here to argue on behalf of Derek Fuller, who was convicted in the Superior Court of several misdemeanor drug offenses and sentenced to maximum imprisonment terms on those offenses. There is an important sentencing issue here that I intend to address. However, I don't want to ignore, in the limited time available, some important trial issues. So I need to touch, I believe I need to touch upon those. The first issue that we've raised is the non-responsive remark of the police officer to a question just by the prosecutor to the effect that, well, he was arrested at gunpoint because we received information that he was armed. And the court took, I just want to emphasize that the Superior Court took extraordinary steps at this trial. It was raised by counsel. Superior Court was aware of the problem. Superior Court instructed the prosecution to take care that no extraneous prejudicial information entered the picture. And what happened? This happened. The trial court was, to put it mildly, in consternation that it happened, if the record indicates. The trial court, as the Superior Court nearly always does, took the resort of giving instruction, the last resort, giving instruction to the jury to disregard the mark, to disregard the remark. But I only want to point out that I asked the court to consider, says the context, and look at the, says the wording, says of that instruction. The instruction, the emphasis in that instruction to ladies and gentlemen, says, I don't know how this happened, you must ignore, says that comment, but that only highlights the prejudice involved. And for that reason, because of the extreme prejudice, because the defense did everything that it could to prevent this from happening, such a gratuitous remark, to permit it to occur and be cured by a jury instruction under all circumstances, a jury instruction to, you know, ignore the elephant in the courtroom sometimes doesn't work, and this was such a case. The similar issue is the admission of the police officer's testimony to the effect that the defense moved pretrial to exclude the comment about objected to the comment about, are you going to go to court with that statement? The defendant gave a post-arrest statement to the effect that, I don't know how it got there, some Colombian drug dealers working on my car, must have put it there. Well, the police officer expressed skepticism about that, doubt, and said, do you expect to go to court with that issue? That should have been excluded. There was no reason for that to be admitted. It was admitted, and what it did was impinge upon the defendant's Fifth Amendment right to remain silent because he exercised that right to remain silent, and that remark was unfairly prejudicial in that context. The third issue is the intent to arrest the defendant during trial. We submit that this goes to the core of the right to confrontation. The state had decided that the police officer was going to arrest, the defendant's brother during trial after he had testified that the drugs were his and not the defendant's. The defense attempted to cross-examine, says, on that basis. The state objected, the court excluded. What is more important than to confront a state's witness about, says, their intent to arrest others for the offense? If a situation arises at trial where the state has arrested somebody and put them in prison the year before, and I or some other attorney is defending another person who's accused of that same offense, well, someone else, if we attempt to cross-examine the officer, didn't you testify, says, last year in a trial that so-and-so was guilty of this offense and he's now in prison for it? To preclude cross-examination under those circumstances is simply wrong. This doesn't mean that the state doesn't have an opportunity to respond to the question. No, the reason why we're going to arrest them is because the problem is there's no confrontation right ability to be exercised there. The fourth problem is the joint possession instruction. The court gave an instruction on joint possession. The defense objected to it. There was no basis for that instruction, says, in the trial evidence. None whatsoever. The prosecution didn't ask for it. It was inconsistent with the trial testimony. It was either the defendant's or the defendant's brother's. And there was no evidence of joint possession, and a joint possession instruction was given. And what happened? We had a verdict which made no sense. that is explained by the, could be explained by the joint possession instruction. And in those circumstances, it raises the possibility that six jurors could have thought, well, it was the defendants. Six jurors could have thought, well, it's the defendants' brothers. Well, perhaps they jointly possessed it. Juries do these things when they're not given accurate instructions as to the law, and there is no evidence to support this instruction. The fifth issue that we're raising is a sentencing issue. This is, of course, very important because one aspect of this issue is novel to the court. It's novel to it's not novel to the United States Supreme Court because it decided Blakely about two months ago. However, it's novel to courts across the land, state courts and federal courts. The first aspect of that issue, however, is not necessarily raised in the Blakely context. The trial court found that the defendant had suborned or acquiesced in his brother's perjury at trial, and the trial court concluded that the brother had testified falsely based upon his subsequent guilty plea, and therefore the trial court was permitted to enhance the defendant's sentence. The trial court enhanced the defendant's sentence, and the trial court identified as part of the reason for enhancing the defendant's sentence and giving him a maximum sentence is because that he had suborned or acquiesced in perjury. We raised the point, we have argued the point, that there is insufficient evidence here to punish the defendant for subornation of perjury under these circumstances or acquiescence in perjury under these circumstances, because the only thing this record indicates is that he exercised his right to remain silent. This is comparable to a situation where if a defendant is accused of robbery and goes to trial, and the defendant's mother comes in and testifies that, no, my son didn't go out that day, he was home all day with me. The defendant does not testify. The jury returns a verdict of guilty. Under those circumstances, can the trial court enhance the defendant's sentence to a maximum imprisonment term for robbery because he acquiesced or suborned perjury? We submit not under those circumstances, because if a defendant sits there and remains mute, and there's no evidence of any conspiracy, there's no evidence of any, his lawyer who is presenting a defense. The defendant has not testified. There is no evidence that does not contravene the Fifth Amendment that is permissible to enhance the sentence to maximum imprisonment. The last issue, as I'd like to address, is the issue raised by...
Before you leave that, are you saying when a defendant's lawyer decides to call a witness that the defendant has absolutely no connection with that decision and no responsibility for how the defense is presented?
Yes, on this record says yes, because under the circumstances, a lawyer can independently investigate, and a lawyer's duty is to speak with witnesses, to talk with people, and if they say, if the defendant's mother says, couldn't have been at the bank, he was home all day with me. And the defendant testified, and the defendant said to his lawyer, I don't want to testify, I've got a prior record, and the jury will hold that against me. And the lawyer presents the mother's testimony. There's nothing in the record to suggest that doesn't have an obligation in the Fifth Amendment. If his mother goes up, even if she lies, to jump up and say, Your Honor, I can't permit that, I'm guilty.
Well, can the judge take judicial notice of the perjury conviction of the witness?
No, we don't believe so. Because besides the unreliability aspects raised in the opening brief, that the circumstances were coercive on these facts, there is one mistake by the state in its brief. This trial judge didn't take the guilty plea of Ian Fuller. It was another, Judge Hurley, who took the guilty plea. That's a very short guilty plea, and it's appended to one of the state's filings in response to the defense motion for judgment of acquittal or new trial, motion for judgment of acquittal in Superior Court, which was denied. Under these circumstances, we submit that the court can't take judicial notice of it because it's unreliable. And one of the reasons why we see it is prima facie, constitutionally unreliable, is Blakely. And it is a hearsay statement, no matter what, even if the trial court can't accept, because Derek Fuller didn't get an opportunity to confront his brother's admission of guilt implicating him, sort of like a written statement. Didn't get an opportunity to confront it. And yet we have a situation whereby the judge is increasing the otherwise maximum sentence.
Well, and that, let's go back for a moment. Your point is that, putting blankly to one side, there was simply no cognizable evidence, no evidence of subordination or acquiescence in perjury.
Yes, sir.
How would there ever be such evidence unless the that is, if the defendant remained silent?
There usually, in most cases, there wouldn't be. In most cases where this arises, where the defendant's sentence is enhanced,
it would take an admission on somebody's part, correct?
It would take an admission on somebody's part. The state would have to, you know, put together, you know, a case. The defendant would have to admit it somehow. There'd have to be evidence apart from the defendant's silence to support such an inference.
And most likely, an admission by somebody, one of the two perpetrators.
An admission doesn't usually come to fore, Your Honor, because in most of the cases where the defendant is sentenced is for perjury or suborning perjury, the defendant himself has testified at trial. So there's no Fifth Amendment question. So the defendant, as in Dunnigan, which the state relies on, the defendant's punishment is being enhanced for his perjury, his mistruths on the stand. That's entirely distinguishable from sitting at the defense table silent, as the Fifth Amendment permits the defendant to do.
Well, was this addressed at sentencing?
Yes.
Sufficiency of the basis for any inference of participation in suborning perjury?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes,
and so the trial judge considered everything that was said at that time?
Yes.
Or not said?
Yes. And to give the trial judge credit, the trial judge, there's a passage in there where the trial judge says this, but let me make it clear, I'm enhancing the sentence because of, you know, the perjury aspects of it. The trial judge didn't try to evade it.
And what's
I raised it.
What's the maximum sentence that the trial judge could have imposed absent that finding?
The maximum sentence, that takes us into Blakely. The maximum sentence without that finding was probation under the Sentax's guidelines.
As a matter of law, isn't it the statutory maximum?
As a matter of law, the statutory maximum? Not now, Your Honor. Under the court's prior jurisprudence in Ward, in Mays, and Gaines, in Seiple, the court in 1987 issued an administrative regulation declaring that the sentencing guidelines were non-binding and voluntarily, and non-binding and voluntary. That decision was reached in a non-adversary setting, in a non-justiciable controversy. It was an administrative decision. Later on, since the court affirmed its prior holding in several of those later decisions, including Seiple, but we don't think that this point was argued. And it could not have been argued because at that time, says Blakely, says did not exist. There is a passage in Seiple that if the court permits me, I would like to refer to. The passage is, I misplaced my reading glasses to this morning, so if the court would bear with me. This court does have appellate jurisdiction to review criminal sentences on the basis of alleged unconstitutionally factual predicates which either false, impermissible, or lack minimum indicia of reliability. Factual predicates which are impermissible. At the time Seiple was decided in 1997, that factual predicate, a fact which had not been found by the jury beyond a reasonable doubt, was a permissible reason to enhance a sentence. Now, because of Blakely, it is not. So under Blakely, the defendant's alleged perjury for subornation of perjury. Excuse me, the defendant's alleged subornation of perjury or acquiescence in perjury is not a permissible factual predicate to enhance a sentence, as under Blakely. It's no longer. Prescience on the court's part, the court.
Substantively or procedurally?
Both, Your Honor. Both.
And so your position is, A, there's no evidence of this factual predicate. But even if there were, since the jury did not make a finding, then Blakely precludes an enhancement.
Yes, Your Honor. If I could quote one more passage from a case.
You realize you're in your rebuttal time?
Yes,
there,
sir, I know. The statutory scheme, quote, permits the judge to impose an exceptional sentence within the maximum range determined by the legislature, citation. Because the statutory and non-statutory aggravating factors neither increase the maximum sentence nor define separate offenses calling for separate penalties, the Apprendi rule is not triggered. Now, what does that quote from a judicial decision sound like? It sounds like the state's argument here. It sounds identical to the state's argument here. The judge didn't go beyond the statutory maximum. It sounds like a reiteration of cycle, of gains, of reward. But that quote doesn't come from cycle. It doesn't come from any Delaware decision. That quote is from the Washington Appellate Court's decision in Blakely. And that's the problem here. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Police the Court.
Good afternoon, Mr. Dunham.
Good afternoon. I'd like to start with the sentencing issue. I think there are about five, really two issues in the sentencing. One is a traditional type of issue that this court has been reviewing, pre-Sentak, post-Sentak, pre-Blakely, post-Blakely. That is the judge exhibiting a closed mind, various factors that this court considers. Is the court considering a fact, an impermissible factor? Does the factor the court consider have demonstrably lack indicia of reliability? Here it seems to be that the defendant's argument is that the defendant's role, that the defendant played a role in his brother's perjury, lacked demonstrative indicia of reliability, and therefore the court, the sentencing judge, erred in considering it. Now this has nothing to do with Blakely. This is under this court's traditional review of sentences, which again generally ends with the determination that the sentence falls within statutory limits. However, if the defendant can demonstrate some of these other factors, then the court will consider and review the sentence and remand for resentencing. In this case, the judge, and I went back to the first page of the sentencing transcript, the Superior Court said that, how does the court know that Ian Fuller pled guilty to perjury? The court accepted that plea. I admit there's a certain ambiguity in that. I took it to mean that the sentencing judge here, maybe it was another judge. But anyway, the court can certainly take judicial notice of its own records, and I don't think there's any doubt that Ian Fuller did in fact plead guilty to perjury at Derek Fuller's trial by coming in and saying that the drugs were his and that his brother did not know that he had concealed them in the trunk of his car.
Well, let's assume hypothetically that was true. What do we have in the record that shows the contrary? Let's assume in my hypothetical that a defendant is really surprised drugs are in the trunk and says, you know, somebody else's drugs, they're not mine. And then, that's a true statement in my hypothetical. The brother comes in and says, they're my drugs, tells the lawyer that, and says, I want to testify to that effect. And assuming my hypothetical, that's what happens. And the defendant's convicted. And when the brother pleads guilty to perjury, as we have in this case, how do we get to involving the defendant in my hypothetical and the brother's perjury?
Well, we get there by fact of the brother's plea of guilty to perjury. Now, had the brother not pled guilty to perjury, and this is where Mr. O'Donnell's mother coming in and testifying that my son was with me on the night of the robbery, we were watching television, she's never pled guilty to perjury. She may very well have been mistaken. Besides, she's the defendant's mother.
Well, no, in my hypothetical, we'll assume that, you know, these brothers are close, and sometime in the past, one brother had done something for the brother who's now committing perjury, and that it could very well have been the brother's drugs, and the defendant had no reason to think it wasn't. But what we find with 20/20 hindsight is the person was intentionally committing perjury to save his brother from going to jail because he'd rather go himself. So in my hypothetical, I'm trying to paint a picture where the brother is really committing perjury to do a favor for his sibling, but there's no involvement at all. I mean, that's possible. So how do we show the opposite? How do we show active involvement in getting someone to commit perjury?
Well, I think it has to be what the sentencing judge said in this case. I mean, it's an inference the judge draws from the fact that Ian Fuller shows up and testifies as he did. And as the judge said, I cannot imagine Ian Fuller unilaterally coming in here and doing this. And of course, it wasn't, Ian Fuller would not have ended up taking the same fall, if you will, that his brother Derek would, because Ian had no prior record. Well, his brother did. So his brother was facing a minimum sentence. Had he been convicted on all charges of something over 23 years, well, the brother would have gotten 5. So,
Mr. Donovan,
yes, sir.
The issue here is what is the evidence of either subordination or acquiescence? And I gather that what the trial judge did and what you appear to be arguing is to say, well, you know, if the brother perjures himself on the witness stand, how could that possibly have happened without some involvement, whether by subordination or acquiescence of the defendant?
Yes.
So it's almost an ipso facto argument, isn't it?
Yes.
But that ipso facto argument doesn't necessarily dispose of the case that Justice Holland was talking about, where in fact the defendant has a pure mind and no involvement.
Yes, well, I mean, certainly Justice Holland's hypothetical was looking down on that hypothetical and the facts from the eye of God. Of course, we don't know in the real world who has whose drugs these actually are. I mean, Ian Fuller may very well have been correct when he said those drugs belong to me, and incorrect when he said my brother didn't know they were in the car.
Well, that's another theme in the brief. It is, again, if we look at it after the fact, the brother who pled guilty to perjury, they could have been his drugs, and he could have decided that pleading guilty to perjury was a lot better than getting convicted of possessing the drugs that he admitted were his. But even under that scenario, we still have the defendant on the sideline, not involved. You know, the brother made a unilateral decision to commit perjury that turned out not to be such a good decision. What we're trying to do is, normally when you're here talking to us about circumstantial evidence, we go from one step to another, and there's a logical progression where you can only reach one conclusion. In fact, the sentence was imposed because the judge reached this conclusion about active involvement in the perjury, and what we're looking for in the record is some support for that, other than the fact that his brother did it.
That his brother did commit perjury.
Right.
Right. And the inference the judge drew from that was that his brother acquiesced at a minimum in the perjury. His brother was obviously in the courtroom, and Derek, rather, was obviously in the courtroom, the defendant, while his brother testified. Well, he did not have to jump up and say to the judge, my brother's committing a perjury, I'm guilty. There's certainly a middle ground between that and just sitting silently.
What is it?
And listening to it.
What's the middle ground?
Talking to your attorney.
And then?
Then the attorney takes whatever steps the attorney feels are ethical under those circumstances.
But somewhere in connecting those dots, you're assuming the defendant who didn't jump up was guilty. And if he's sitting there at the trial with this presumption of innocence, and as Mr. O'Donnell said, he doesn't have to testify, and let's assume some people who get arrested really are innocent.
Yeah.
How do we distinguish between these people? You're suggesting there's only one conclusion, that a guilty defendant was sitting there knowing his brother was committing perjury. And Mr. O'Donnell suggesting that might not have been the case.
Well, there are certain obviously other evidence in the case. The drugs were found in the defendant's car. Car that had been driven by the defendant and owned by the defendant. Certainly, that takes one a long way towards the defendant possessing these drugs. But I think the trial judge was not relying on, and again, the standard I think is important here, relying on evidence so lacking in indicia of reliability that, in fact, was unreasonable to do so.
Well, let's leave that point and tell us, in your view, if the Delaware sentencing guidelines are really analogous to the federal sentencing guidelines, because historically we have thought they were not.
Yes, and I agree. I don't think from the commentators I've read on this, the commentators, whatever they know, don't think so either. This court, right from the beginning, when the guidelines were adopted in 1987 through Administrative Directive 77, and then later those were incorporated in cases like Ward v. State and all the other cases this court has, decisions this court has handed down since then, emphasized that the guidelines in Delaware are voluntary, non-binding, and that defendant has no statutory or constitutional right to appeal a decision, appeal a sentencing that falls outside the guidelines. For that reason alone. Now, the defendant can argue other things that the defendant is arguing here, but this has nothing to do with Blakely. Because the guidelines in Delaware are regarded as voluntary, non-binding, and I think most importantly, non-appealable. Non-appealable. They fall outside the reach of Blakely. Unlike the Washington statutory guidelines, which were certainly appealable. As a matter of fact, Justice Scalia says in his majority opinion somewhere, had the judge gone outside the guidelines without giving a reason, he would have been reversed.
But is the logical extension of your argument that there could never be a sentence enhancement in a non-capital case in Delaware, because as long as you don't go above the statutory maximum, by analogy, you're not outside the
guidelines.
Is that the state's position?
But you're outside the guidelines. I mean, the guidelines do have a guideline recommendation, recommended sentence, and the sentences here fell outside that. I think for, I disagree about,
but my question to you is, when you're beyond the guidelines in Delaware, can you properly characterize that as enhancing the sentence? Or are you only, how do you enhance a sentence in Delaware if the guidelines are totally irrelevant and you give the statutory maximum?
Well, it's an enhanced guideline sentence, but that standing alone does not create an appealable issue. I mean, this court has made that clear. You simply can't point and say, look, my sentence was outside the guidelines, but within the statutory maximum, and that's wrong.
But what Mr. O'Donnell is saying is, if, in fact, you can enhance a sentence short of the maximum in Delaware, then there are certain things that require a type of determination that was not made in this case.
I don't think I follow you. Well, the guidelines themselves state that a reason for an upward or downward departure from the guideline recommendations must be stated on the record.
Well, what's the consequence for not doing that?
Well, I think this court could certainly remand.
Well, we had a case, you'll recall, where a judge said, and I'm giving you this particular sentence because you had a weapon during the commission of this offense. Turned out to be there wasn't a weapon. The judge just had a couple of defendants confused. And we said in the absence of a proper factual predicate, that was an improper sentence, and you had to resentence the person on the assumption that, on the fact, that they didn't have a weapon.
Yes.
So here, if the judge said, I'm giving you this sentence because you participated in your brother's perjury, and there's not a factual basis for that in the record, is the remedy remanding it for resentencing?
Yes. Yes. But that really has nothing to do with Blakely. This is right. What's traditional review of sentences.
Right. Your Blakely argument is that because there is an almost total dissimilarity between the binding nature of the federal sentencing guidelines and basically the absence of any binding quality of the Delaware guidelines,
right,
that the procedural requirements of Blakely don't apply.
Yes. Yes.
That is, that there is an enhancement, and that enhancement does have a factual predicate in the record. The enhancement, that factual predicate does not have to be determined by the jury in Delaware.
No. Yeah, because the guidelines are basically voluntary and non-binding. So Delaware remains a state in which the trial judge retains the discretion to sentence anywhere within up to the statutory maximum. This court can look at the record and say, well, imposing this sentence, the court exhibited a closed mind, the court relied on impermissible factors, the court relied on a factor that lacked minimal indicia of reliability, which is, I think, is what Mr. O'Donnell is arguing in this case. But this falls outside of Blakely. This falls within this court's traditional review of sentence, pre-sentac and post-sentac.
In your view, in this case, the only issue is, was there a reasonable basis in the evidence to support the judge's conclusion that the defendant was involved in the brother's perjury?
Yes. Yes. Well, did the trial judge make an inference that finds some minimal support on this record? And the state's position is that yes, he did. There is minimal support on this record for that finding. That
because he was related to the person who gave the perjury testimony, or because of some other additional reason?
Well, I think the trial judge was looking at a couple of things. First of all, that there is the familial relationship. I'm sure that played a role. This just wasn't some stranger that came in off the street. Also, the judge realized, and this is on the record, that if Ian took the fall for this, his term, mandatory term of imprisonment would have been less than half of that, I think less than 25% that his brother would have received had he been convicted of all charges. And I think the judge also placed on Ian's testimony the reason why the jury probably came back with that kind of an odd verdict, guilty of possession but not guilty of trafficking. Maybe they did believe that some of the drugs belonged to him. I mean, this court has had cases like that before. And the jury just says, well, we don't know how much is owned by one and how much is owned by the other, so we can't say he's guilty of trafficking. But we do know he's guilty of possession, so we'll just find him guilty of possession. So it may have played out in that way. the jury may have believed part of Ian's testimony, but decided that the defendant also had a ownership interest in the drugs, and rather than, since there was no way to apportion it, find him guilty of simple possession.
Are you saying that whenever a witness who is related to the defendant gives false testimony, and whether that's proven by a conviction for perjury or a plea to perjury, or if the judge just is convinced that it's false, that the judge can enhance the sentence of the defendant for that reason?
No, I'm not saying that. I mean, certainly it might be a fact to consider, but I'm not saying every time that mom comes in and says, hypothetical, that you're going to go after mom for perjury, or even if mom does commit perjury, and that's somehow proven. I'm not sure how, but in this case, I mean, there's no mistake, obviously.
Well, help us come up with a list. If we're going to write an opinion consistent with your view, when we're listing the record support for the judge's conclusion, the only thing on the list right now is they were brothers. Now, what else is on the list to support the judge's conclusion that the defendant was actively involved in having his brother commit perjury?
Well, the judge, I think from that, from the fact that he pled guilty to perjury, and the fact that their familial relationship, the fact that Ian's punishment was going to be considerably less than Derek's punishment, the judge put some emphasis on that. The judge, from those factors, reached the conclusion that Derek really put his brother up to doing this, and that his brother, being a dutiful brother, went along with it. I mean, that seems to be the conclusion that the judge reached from those factors.
The brother was not asked that. There's nothing. Why wasn't that done? Whether the perjury plea agreement.
Well, I know that from the sentencing judge mentioning that during the sentencing that the brother made no statement either prior to sentencing or at sentencing, and so there's no record basis. He never said my brother put me up to it. He just pled guilty to perjury, and that was it.
That would have been helpful to you, all of your arguments.
Definitely.
You think that the state might have had a little leverage with that the witness and said you can either go to jail a long time for your admitted testimony under oath that you were involved in the drugs, or you can avail yourself of a shorter sentence if you plead guilty to perjury, but we're going to let you pick your crime based on telling us, you know, why you committed perjury in the first place.
Right. Definitely. And it's actually, that could go simply right into the plea agreement. And that would have been the simplest way to do it. And then he could admit to perjury under these circumstances, and then the trial judge, of course, could then use that to reach a conclusion. But unfortunately, according to the sentencing judge in this case, that was not done. And so we have the bare fact of whom falls guilty to perjury.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Attorney Donald, you have about 3 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. The defense would like to respond to some of the state's arguments concerning Blakely initially. One of the things we'd like to point out that insofar as the Blakely decision and its import for this court in deciding as the sentencing issue in this case, I'd like to point out that Washington's sentencing scheme is remarkably similar to Delaware's in all material respects, except for one factor. Delaware established a sentencing accountability commission, which identified aggravators and mitigators for purposes of enhancing or diminishing sentences. The Washington legislature did that themselves. That's the only distinction I could find between the two statutes. However, if the court will note, and I've noted it in the supplemental memorandums, Justice O'Connor points out in Blakely, the majority decision, it does not matter under the majority decision whether the sentencing guidelines are established by delegated administrative exercise or by the legislature itself.
So that's an immaterial difference.
In your view, to comport with Blakely, what would have had to have happened in this case?
To comport with Blakely? What would have had to have happened? Bifurcated to proceeding, a sentencing proceeding where the jury participated?
And the jury would not have been deciding the issue of perjury, it would have been deciding the issue of the defendant's involvement in the perjury.
Perhaps, yes. Now, that may be impractical, but we're dealing with Delaware sentencing scheme at that time, trying to, you know, adapt from that. Second point I'd like to make, that prior to Blakely, in Washington, the deliberate cruelty enhancement was not appealable because it was with it. The sentence imposed to Mr. Blakely was not appealable because it was less than the statutory maximum under Blakely. We now know that it is appealable. And that's comparable to the situation we now face in Delaware.
So we no longer have an indeterminate sentencing system? Is that your position?
We don't want... No, that's... No, I do not believe so. Because the Sentac guidelines permit a range of sentencing within... for the offense itself without findings of aggravators or mitigators. So it's indeterminate in that respect. But where it takes a fact finding to go beyond that sentence, presumptive sentencing range, Blakely is implicated.
So you read Blakely as applying to indeterminate sentencing systems?
Yes.
And you also read Blakely as applying to non-binding types of sentencing guidelines?
Not all. But the problem here is in Delaware, we thought that it was non-binding before and non-appealable. But under Blakely, our contention, the defense's contention, is that our original surmise is incorrect, says under Blakely. Because what happens if a defendant is sentenced and given a maximum sentence, and the defense attorney says, Your Honor, what's the aggravator? I'm not stating an aggravator. I decline to recite one. And it gets to this court. It's reversed because there's no aggravator to rely upon. And if there's no aggravator that's required to be relied upon and it will get reversed, then we no longer have a voluntary non-binding sentencing system under Blakely.
Thank you, Mr. O'Donnell.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and we will also take a brief recess.